Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Gateway Market and Cafe. Gateway brings together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. Check out Gateway Market and Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry. Joe has 23 years in the real estate business. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. Hey, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. Big day today, and we're recording this program on Martin Luther King Day, which has been a federal holiday since, I didn't realize it went back so far, 1983. So which president signed it into made it a federal holiday? Well, Ronald Reagan. So, and now we have, again, since, 2011, the national parks have had this fee-free day for national holidays, including ML King Day. And more recently, Juneteenth was added to that list. But in stark contrast to President Reagan, we have President Trump now negating the value of ML King Day and Juneteenth. They are no longer on the list of national holidays that you can expect to go to a national park and not have to pay a fee. Of course, added to the list is Flag Day, which is June 14th, which is not coincidentally, in my opinion, or in the opinion of many, also President Trump's birthday. So basically, we're getting rid of the two holidays that matter most to the black community, and we're adding in Trump's birthday. Who doesn't see some problem with that? I mean, is there anybody out there who thinks that's fair, reasonable, you know, good in any way, shape, or form? So one thing special about ML King Day is it's a national day of service, public service. It's been recognized, you know, kind of casually, but a lot of service projects happen on ML King Day, including at national parks. In fact, the National Park website says, and I'll quote, "Volunteering your time and talent on Martin Luther King Day helps make Dr. King's vision of a beloved community a reality." And they give examples like planting trees, cleaning up trails, removing graffiti, picking up litter. But this year, that's out, you know. That's out. So is Juneteenth. But again, Flag Day, a.k.a. Trump's birthday, is in. And I don't know how anybody cannot see what's going on here. I mean, you cancel the two holidays important to the black community, and you wonder why some people think you might be a racist. You know, of course, I mean, so many examples, but the one that comes to my mind is him having, a few years ago, Nick Fuentes over for a dinner at Mar-a-Lago. Now, Fuentes is that self-described white Christian nationalist. That's not me calling him a white Christian nationalist. That's his own term. He calls himself a white Christian nationalist. He's also a Holocaust denier. You know, and I could go on and on about Trump's statements that make it clear that he's a racist. I mean, I don't throw that word around lightly, but clearly what's going on is not even subtle. There's nothing subtle about it. I do want to make a comment about ML King Day as a day of national service, and that's, you know, that's good. I'm glad people are picking up litter, clearing trails, you know, volunteering in whatever way possible in their hometown. But the danger of just calling it a day of national service is to ignore that the much deeper importance of King's work and the 1960s struggle in general. the struggle for justice and civil rights. I mean, that was not just about public service. It was about justice, about civil rights, about standing up against oppression. And I think that's the most important part of recognizing ML King Day. Public service, good, you know, picking up litter, great, but there are deeper concerns, and those are sometimes ignored by people who celebrate this day. So, you know, it's also important to remember and to emphasize too that struggle in the 1960s was nonviolent. You know, I mean, black people and their white allies getting clubbed and arrested on the news, night after night, peacefully protesting. You know, I mean that made a big impact on people. You know, I know at the risk of getting canceled, I've been canceled before, so I can take it. I'm going to throw down a challenge to people who are currently protesting the injustice and discrimination on tap every night regarding Trump and the ICE approach to dealing with immigration. You know, I mean, I see so many examples. I don't even know where to start, but there's a new short little ditty out of a large crowd, I think in Minneapolis. I can't remember the entire song. It's certainly not worth remembering, in my opinion. But it basically concludes by calling Kristi Noem the C word, which I can't say on an FCC-regulated station and don't really want to say. The whole crowd is chanting that and calling her that name. There's plenty of footage of people throwing snowballs and other stuff at officers or at people who are supporting the immigration raid. Screaming obscenities and doing other things that seem to me to not fit the definition of nonviolence. And to be clear, I am not a strict pacifist. There are situations in which pacifism is not the appropriate response, and we can talk more about that. And I know I have pacifist friends who are purists when it comes to nonviolence. My argument is that nonviolence is almost always the best strategy, but that you can't embrace pure pacifism. If you do, then there are cases where you will be avoiding your moral obligation to respond to injustice. But that's another conversation. Right now, we're dealing with a situation where I think nonviolence is absolutely the right approach. And you know, we've got Martin Luther King Jr. as an example. Not that long ago, our own country, one of our greatest leaders, a national holiday that recognizes him, that used to get you a free pass into national parks, but doesn't anymore for now. And we've got plenty of other historical examples of how nonviolent action can and should work in this kind of a situation. And I highly recommend to you a book by Paul and Mark Engler, This is an Uprising, which talks about a wide range of struggles. One of the most memorable, in my opinion, is what transpired in Serbia about 25 years ago in response to the dictatorship of Slobodan Milosevic. I want to share with you, though, again, further back, Mahatma Gandhi, and Gandhi, everybody who is doing anything relevant to nonviolent action has taken a page from Gandhi's work. And I want to share with you some thoughts from one of the best books written about Gandhi's approach to social change, called Conquest of Violence by Joan Bondurant. And she talks about the Gandhian Code of Discipline, which he set for his volunteers back in the 1930s struggle, one of many struggles. And I'll read some of these points to you. One, harbor no anger, but suffer the anger of the opponent. Refuse to return the assaults of the opponent. Two, do not submit to any order given in anger, even though severe punishment is threatened for disobeying. Three, refrain from insults and swearing. Four, protect opponents from insult or attack, even at the risk of life. I'll skip a couple there that really aren't relevant to our situation and go to seven, if taken prisoner, behave in an exemplary manner. And eight, as a member of a Satyagraha unit, Satyagraha was the name of the movement, as a member of a Satyagraha unit, obey the orders of Satyagraha leaders and resign from the unit in the event of serious disagreement. You know, I see those traits sadly lacking in the movement in opposition to ICE. And I understand where people are coming from. I mean, I wake up, I start, my first thing to do in the morning after brewing a strong cup of tea is to read the news. And it's hard not to be angry. It's hard not to be very frustrated about what's going on and to want to vent and shout and scream and swear. And yeah, it's easy to do. I get it. But it's not the best response in terms of either the moral imperative to respond to this kind of hostility, negativity, evil. It's also not the best response in terms of effectiveness. And I think it's nice when those two things can come together. So yeah, I mean, you look at the video footage from the 1960s of black men sitting at counters in a restaurant, having food thrown at them, drink thrown at them, being thrown out of the restaurant, being arrested. The water cannons, the dogs. You see all these. You think people being taken off the freedom buses and being beaten, and you see, in the struggle for independence in India. Gandhi once, he was already in jail, but his community led an action at a salt mine in which people nonviolently just walked, approached the salt mine intending to get inside, and they did not raise a hand when they were beaten by clubs. Beaten with clubs by guards. And the effect that had globally was to mobilize the international opinion against the British Empire. Just as here in the U.S., the images of blacks and their white allies being beaten and hosed and attacked by dogs in the 1960s mobilized American opinion against the oppression. In this case, oppression of local officials. An interesting twist here now is, we're kind of rooting for the local officials and seeing the oppression come from the federal government, which is a very disturbing change. So anyway, again, you can cancel me if you like. I've been canceled before, but I strongly think that this is not the way to go. And I want to slightly switch geographic approaches here. I want to look at Greenland, but on the same topic. And Trump is doubling down on his threats to take Greenland. And it's just kind of taking a bizarre twist this week with him saying that, because Norway didn't give me the Nobel Peace Prize, that's one reason I'm motivated to take Greenland. Wow. That's like a whole new level of narcissism and petulant, childishness. But a good friend of mine, a very good friend, sent me a video last night. It was of Greenland preparing to defend itself against Donald Trump. And it was clever. It was funny. It was really good, actually. There were polar bears driving dog sleds, which it's just great, right? Now, there was a phalanx of walruses, and one of them smoking a cigar. And the bears and the walruses and all the native people, the native Greenlanders, are standing there or on skis or on some kind of snowmobile, ready to defend their home against, and this is a quote from the video, a hungry giant who wants to take our shores and drink the oil and eat the ore. And that's a reference to Trump, of course. And they even show a little image of Trump coming in on a boat, pointing to the coastline that he wants to monopolize, that he wants to steal. And since this is radio and you can't see what I'm seeing, these polar bears, walruses, the people, even some penguins, are all armed to the hilt with guns and spears. So even beyond the question of whether or not you believe nonviolence is the best approach, do you really think that 57,000 Greenlanders, that's the total population, plus whatever European allies want to send in terms of soldiers, do you really believe that's going to stop the U.S. military? I mean, Trump says, he'll follow through on his threat to take it the hard way. And we know what that means. That means military force. You can bring all the troops you want, all the well-armed polar bears and walruses, and it's not going to stop the U.S. military. But I think what will stop the U.S. military would be a campaign along the lines of all the nonviolent struggles we've seen throughout our history that have perhaps less dramatically, perhaps more slowly, but have effectively eliminated the threat of a tyrant, of a hungry giant in this case. So again, what is this hungry giant after? Of course, so he wants to invade Greenland because, world opinion is already against him. When we see the reasons that he wants to come in and take Greenland, you know, it becomes really obvious that this is not really about protecting America from Russia or China. This is about a huge trove of minerals and oil and resources that Trump thinks that we deserve to take. And, you know, you look at the map of Greenland. I saw a map the other day about where the different mineral and mineral assets lie. And they're there. They're all over the place. And right now, Greenland won't touch them because they do not believe in extractive mining. They also don't even own private property. Well, if the U.S. takes over, you can bet, you know, there will be private property. It will be owned by corporations, and there will be mining. And again, some of the biggest tech bros that are lining up to take advantage of this are some of Trump's big supporters, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos. They know what's under the ground, and they are drooling to get it. That is what this is being. That's what this is all about. This is not about, even though Trump says he's upset about not getting the Nobel Peace Prize, that's not the real reason. Even though he says he's concerned about security, that's not the real reason. It's about the wealth. This is Avatar, but instead of blue people defending their planet against an imperial power, it's native people. Yeah, and polar bears and walruses. And I know in Avatar they use spears and other weapons to fight off the invaders. And that seems to be pretty much always what you see in Hollywood. But we have history to show us that there are other ways of defending oneself, one's land, one's freedom against imperialists, against conquerors. And I think, you know, whether it's in Greenland or in the streets of Minneapolis, I for one am very strongly embracing nonviolence as the vastly preferred and vastly and morally superior approach to dealing with these conflicts. Hey, I'm going to take a short break. Back in a minute, we're going to be talking about why we need darkness. And later in the program, in our lighter segment, which I'm trying to include a lighter segment every week, we're going to be talking about why Irish music is the best music in the world. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
Oh, ancient land of ice and stone, Kalala knew not forever a home. A hungry giant wants to take our shore to drink the oil and eat the ore. Now hear the Kalala go through the deep and wake every soul from their sleep. Greenland defense, front stay tall, orange and reaches, but his fingers freeze and fall. Oh, let the drums mark this day. No more strangers lead the way. Bear the hunter, the spirits rise to pluck the greed from the stranger's eyes. We carve the tuba like to hunt the ghost, tear the foul spirit from our sacred coast.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Catholic Peace Ministry. CPM promotes peaceful resolution to war and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. Thanks also to Westrum Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrum and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry. Hey, James Bruton is with me. He's in the studio here. He works as a business consultant, but lives here in Des Moines. He's involved with the Dark Sky Iowa Initiative, something he founded to address a concern that, well, I guess very few other people seem to be talking about, light pollution.
Right. And quite frankly, that's the reason that I've kind of kick-started this initiative. I through the work that I do as a business consultant, I do a lot of strategic planning around the Midwest. I've done a lot of strategic plans for chambers of commerce around the Midwest. And, you know, one of the areas that I've been doing work in is rural Iowa. And, you know, rural Iowa, you know, the small towns, not only do they want to remain relevant, they want to increase their population. They want to be able to attract and retain their businesses. Same with their population. And they're struggling in many regards. And, you know, a lot of the work that I've done is taking a look at economic development opportunities for these rural communities. And, you know, and really, you know, where the whole Dark Sky Initiative came from was that I went to a community connection night in Western, just west of the Des Moines Metro. And, you know, and part of the conversation was going to be, how do we attract people to our small town? And, you know, and I'm just racking my brain trying to figure out, all right, what is it that we can do? What does this small town have that we don't have in the metro? You know, and why are people living there versus living in the metro? And as I started traveling out, west of Waukee, and, you know, this conversation was being had in the evening, I just started to be able to see the night sky. And, you know, which is just something that here in the metro, you know, it's not as terrible as it is in a lot of other, towns.
Getting worse.
It's absolutely getting worse. You know, I look forward to talking about that. But what these rural towns have, and it's getting worse in these rural towns as well, is they have a lot less light pollution. They have the benefit of the night sky. And so I started just diving in and doing a little bit of research into that, really from an economic development standpoint. Mm. Because, you know, dark skies, you know, benefit wildlife, they benefit our health. There's, you know, countless different ways that, you know, dark skies benefit.
How do they benefit wildlife?
In a number of different ways. You know, if the conversation has been had, oftentimes it's around migrating birds. Mm. There's a lot of cities around the U.S. that during times of migration, they will reduce their light on their tall buildings to help migrating birds. Because
there are cities that do that.
There are cities that do that. Yeah,
give me an example.
I know that there are Hancock Center. It's not called the Hancock Center in Chicago anymore. But, you know, they would turn off their bright lights, you know,
really?
at the top of the building.
And what if the whole city would have to do that?
There are, you know, and I don't have the specifics on, exactly everything that's being done. But there are towns and there are cities where, you know, they are working to help reduce light pollution to try not to distract these migrating birds.
And how does light pollution affect humans?
Yeah, there's studies that link certain types of cancer to light pollution, types of disease.
That sounds as believable as windmills cause cancer.
I thought the exact same thing. And it's all relative to it's about our circadian rhythm and how not being able to have the cycle of light and dark, throughout the day, upsets in some respects our circadian rhythm and has been linked to, some aspects of illness and even some cancer.
So sleeping with any kind of a light on is a bad idea.
That's correct.
So sleeping with a huge street light out in front of your bedroom window is a bad idea?
It's a bad idea.
Okay, can you help us with that? We have one of the world's brightest lights I've ever seen right outside of our bedroom window. Kathy bought these shades that are specifically designed to make it darker, but
it's a great question.
In there,
it's a great question. You know, and quite frankly, the city of Des Moines has done a good job with the new lights that they have put in terms of minimizing the upward direction of the light. The light is much more downward directed now than it ever was. The problem is that the light is much wider and a lot brighter.
And our problem is these are quote historic lights.
Gotcha.
And so we actually pay more for them. We pay more to have lights that don't just shine down. They shine straight out into your living room or bedroom.
And, you know, and right. I mean, and this neighborhood, you know, and there are historic lights, you know, that, you know, have downward directed, you know, light as well. It's, you know, and, you know, retrofitting, you know, especially historic lights, you know, can be cost prohibitive. But it also, you know, it also is beneficial to, like I said, to your health. You also think about, you know, how it benefits wildlife. You know, this past summer, you know, Des Moines did not spray for mosquitoes.
Right.
Because of budget constraints. Bats are one of our most effective, insecticides to reduce mosquitoes and other bugs. But you know, excessive light affects bats. You know, and it affects their ability to, you know, to be able to navigate. And there's been studies that show that they completely avoid streetlights. And
we have that in common.
Sure. And both, you know, within the city, you know, being able to, you know, increase the number of bats to reduce, you know, mosquito population is beneficial. You think about the rural population as well, you know, and the farmlands, you know, having natural insecticides to reduce the amount of insects that, you know, that are potentially affecting, you know, our farms. Mm. You know, it's nature's way of taking care of what a lot of times we've disapplied chemicals to do.
So when I was a legislator, and this is back in 1999, a colleague of mine, Cecil Burnett, who I was on very good terms with, introduced a bill that would have begun to address the issue of light pollution. And it was promptly placed in what's called the circular file next to the committee chair's desk. It didn't go anywhere. I know that getting the Hancock Building, whatever it's called, in Chicago to douse its lights during migratory season, you know, maybe getting cities to adapt more responsible street lamps. Beyond all those local initiatives, and maybe that's the best way to go, is there any effort to try to get the state to weigh in on the subject?
I would love for the state to be able to weigh in on this. You know, it affects each of us. You know, I would, you know, where I am right now is really trying to spread the word. I mean, it's a conversation that is just not being had, even within the Nature Conservancy, you know, organizations in the state. I was recently at a conference of a number of different conservation type groups, and dark skies just weren't brought up at all.
And did you bring it up?
I did bring it up.
And what response did you get?
And a lot of people come up to me afterwards thanking me for being there.
Okay.
Thank you for raising the topic.
Yeah.
It was a result of that conversation that Cami Coons from the Iowa Capital Dispatch then reached out to me, because it was someone that heard me speak, heard me ask the question during that event that connected her to me, which has allowed us to be able to have this conversation here today.
I wonder how costly excessive light pollution is. I mean, just in terms of the overlight. I mean, look at these. These car lots. You drive by car lots on the interstate or the Merle Mile, and you could sit out there and read with no trouble at all, even with bad eyes. You know, they're so bright.
Yeah.
I mean, what is the cost of the overkill involved in that kind of an effort, for example?
Yeah, so Dark Sky International, darksky.org, they are an international organization that is helping to raise awareness about this issue. They've done a lot of research, as have a lot of other organizations, and they estimate about 30% of the light that is being produced is completely wasted, that it's going up into the sky or it is going beyond the area that it is intended to light.
And that can be addressed with proper directional lighting.
Absolutely.
And also the right strength of the light, I suppose.
100%. You know, they have, there's a handful of principles that Dark Sky International has. A few of them are, making sure that you're only, you know, shining light where it's needed. The technical term for it is light trespass. You know, and that's what you're talking about, you know, with your street lights.
Yes.
You may have a neighbor that has a floodlight, you know, in their backyard as well that is shining in your window. And any light that is going beyond, you know, the streetlights intended dispersion or your neighbor's lighting that's going beyond, you know, their property line, that's referred to as light trespass. whatever you...
But there's no legal standard for that.
There are things, there are dark sky ordinances that some communities have put into place.
Around the country?
Around the country, yes. Mm-hmm. And it essentially, like trespass, you know, is, quite frankly, is a real easy one. You know, if you have a, right now, if you're in a community that doesn't have any type of or lighting ordinance, your neighbor could effectively shine a 1,000 candle power light directly into your bedroom window, and you would have no recourse. And hopefully your neighbors don't do that. Hopefully you're able to have a conversation. I've had people reach out to me about certain schools here in town who have bright lights, you know, for their sports fields, going all night long, and mm-hmm. there's no one out there at all, and right. those lights are shining directly into their windows. And that's something that can easily be addressed. You know, Musco Lighting here in basically Oskaloosa, works directly with Dark
Joe
Sky.
Joe Crookham,
mm-hmm. Works directly with Dark Sky International.
Really,
they have an entire series of dark sky compliant lighting.
So I would think Musco would be in the business of trying to sell as many high-powered lights as possible.
And they do, but they're also responsible about it.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. That's good to know. Yeah. So, again, one of the aspects of this issue that you mentioned early on that I think is very important, too, is the appreciation we have for a dark sky so we can see the grandeur of the celestial display at night. You don't get to see that often in the city.
No.
And more recently, we've had these tremendous shows of the Northern Lights.
Right.
Which Kathy
tonight,
and I...
There's a possibility tonight in Northern Iowa.
Now you tell me. So Kathy and I once tried to drive outside of town to be able to see, and we couldn't get far enough out of town to be able to really get to a place dark enough to enjoy that. Yeah. And so I would think that, and you were suggesting that might be a possibility for attracting interest in rural communities, a kind of a dark night tourism thing.
There was a study done around the Colorado Plateau, which is kind of the Four Corners region of the United States, that estimated that over a period of 10 years, there would be an increase of $5.8 billion added to the local economy generated just by people that appreciated dark night skies, adding around $2.6 billion in salaries and additional 10,000 jobs. Mm. It's referred to as astrotourism, people just traveling to be able to see the stars. I mean, most of us stare at screens, most of the day, or at least we have one, in our pocket most of the time. Mm. And, our rural communities have the benefit, if they can maintain their dark skies to attract people like you and me who want to be able to get out of the metropolitan area to, let's travel to Stewart, Iowa, and let's take a look at, spend an evening taking a look at the stars. I mean, there's tons of benefits associated with it. Yeah. And I think the potential economic benefits to these small rural towns.
I'm intrigued, too, by the health benefits. You mentioned how it just messes with our rhythms, too. Mm-hmm. And I know it's not great for plants either.
No, there was a recent study that came out, increased CO2 emissions from plants as a result of excess artificial light at night.
Yeah, they like a good night's sleep as well.
They do, yeah, absolutely.
So are there going to be any efforts to introduce legislation this year at the Iowa State House?
This year, I don't know. Right now, I want to raise awareness. Mm-hmm. I would love to get in front of some state legislators. My hope is to build a coalition of partners, like-minded people that this initiative is important to, so that we can start having those conversations.
Do you know of other states where initiatives at the legislative level has been
Maine,
at all successful?
The state of Maine just within the past week passed a dark sky ordinance for the entire state, limiting light trespass, limiting light that's being exposed into the night sky. So yes, it's
and what does it do?
It's essentially a statewide dark sky ordinance.
Really?
Yeah.
And with bipartisan support, or was it a partisan issue?
My understanding is it was bipartisan support, and even here in Iowa, we're bleeding people here in Iowa. We need to be doing everything that we can to attract people to our state. I mean, one of the biggest issues that we have from an economic development standpoint is workforce. And that crosses party lines. Make mm-hmm. sure that we have the right people here in this state to be able to do the work that our local businesses need.
So any other states besides Maine that have either taken an initiative or maybe thinking about it?
There are a number of communities in Arizona, Flagstaff, Arizona, Tucson, Arizona, as individual cities that are dark sky compliant. And if you ever travel to those cities, Tucson, I believe is around 500,000 people, and you can still see the Milky Way when you're inside of that city.
Mm. Well, James, thank you so much for joining us, folks. We've been talking with James Bruton, and he's with the Dark Sky Iowa Initiative. And if folks want to get in touch with you or learn more about the program, what do they do?
Sure. Right now, darkskyiowa.org redirects to a Facebook page that I'm managing. People can also reach me at contact@darkskyiowa.org.
contact@darkskyiowa.org. James, thanks so much for joining us.
Appreciate it, Ed.
Hey, folks, when we come back from a short break, we're going to be talking with John Duvick about why Irish music is the best music in the world. Back in a minute, folks, on the Fallon Forum.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asked that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. Hey, John Duvick is in the studio with me. John is a friend of mine, a fellow musician who plays a couple different traditions, but I think we agree that Irish music is the best music in the world.
It's right up there.
Okay, I'm kidding. I say that, but it is amazing to see how much Irish music has grown around the country. I mean, the Irish festivals.
It's amazing.
Here in Des Moines, there's used to be a session once a month. But that started 34 years ago, and now we've got sessions, seven times a month?
Seven times a month, and it's hard to get a seat in the
circle half
the time.
So tell us a little bit about your background, John.
Right. Well, I came into music probably when I got my first guitar in college. So I was kind of a late bloomer, but I learned a few chords, played a little stand-up bass, and got into some contradance bands as a result of that. So I was a longtime backer of this type of music, the type of music including Irish, Scottish, and kind of what we call Appalachian music, which is played for dances around the country.
Contra dances, so folks know, are basically square dances, but in lines.
Square dances in lines.
Yeah.
And
similar musical repertoire.
Similar repertoire. It's fiddle-based music. It's a driving beat. There's usually guitars, maybe some mandolins and banjos.
Hopefully an accordion.
Hopefully a tasteful accordion.
Wait, is that a contradiction? It's an oxymoron, isn't it?
No, I think there are plenty of tasteful accordion players out there.
You're looking at me.
I'm not sure I know any.
Okay. Right,
no, that's so I've done that for a long time, just as an avocation. And for a long time in Iowa, in fact, the Central Iowa Barn Dance does fourth Saturdays of the month in Ames. I'll put in a little pitch for that during the season. But a few years ago, many years ago actually, I started coming to the Irish session in Des Moines and joined in on guitar. And that was a lot of fun. But if you have too many guitars, it gets a little unwieldy. So I decided I needed to learn a melody instrument, and that's where the fiddle came in.
Well, you know, you play the bouzouki as well.
I've played a little bouzouki as well. Bouzouki is originally a Greek instrument with four courses of strings, like a mandolin, but it's longer and a little more resonant.
Yeah.
And the Irish picked up on the bouzouki
60s, 70s,
decades ago. As a backing instrument and also a melody instrument.
I was in Paris actually, jamming with an Irish group. They would play in front of the Pompidou Center during the day, and then at night we'd hang out and jam till 2 a.m. And there was a bouzouki player from Yugoslavia. I think he was one of the first bouzouki players to find his way into Irish music.
It's an amazing instrument.
Yeah, it is. But even that's not really. I mean, you can play melody on it.
It's a little hard because it's a large instrument. You know, the distance between the frets makes it tough to do fast reels and so forth. So yeah, the real Irish melody instruments would be fiddle, flute, pipes, of course, tin whistle, and accordion.
Thank you. Okay.
So I had to choose one of those, and. It was pretty easy to throw out the accordion. I'm giving Ed a hard time, as many of his listeners know.
I'm used to that.
I mean, accordion, and I love it. But I decided on probably one of the more difficult instruments, which is fiddle, and I'm still struggling with it. But
you've only been playing it for a few years, right?
Well, yeah. But
and an old geezer like you picking up a fiddle, that's pretty impressive.
Well, it goes to show you anyone can do anything if they put their mind to it. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun. But just to back up the claim that Ed made at the beginning of this segment about Irish music being the best, it really is. There is something about it, something about the way it has developed. And of course, it's not a music in a vacuum. Irish music has drawn from Scotland, and possibly other traditions. Certainly on the continent, you know, with some of the mazurkas that are played, but they're given a little flip and a little twist and a little something or other that makes them Irish.
Yeah.
And that something is what is so attractive to a lot of people who want to play, who want to listen, who want to learn these tunes. You know, there are thousands of them.
There's a very notable local blues and jazz rock musician came to one of our sessions a few years ago. And he said to me afterwards, you know, this, I've never really listened to this music. It really, really speaks to me. So there is something about it, and maybe it's the fact that it's so raw in its connection to the land, to the people. I mean, I think that's what traditional music is about. Traditional music is connected in a way that, you know, more stylistic music may not be, to the folkways, the lifestyle, the land itself.
Yep.
Maybe that's it.
That could be. And, you know, having been to Ireland, and of course you have roots in Ireland, you know that the land is gentle, green, but it's also rough, you know.
Yeah, it's not always gentle.
It's not always gentle.
And there are bogs.
And, you know, the people have their style, their rhythm. Mm.
Did you do any sessions when you were in Ireland?
I didn't play, but I watched and listened to a lot of sessions. And, you know, the level of playing is, of course, super high. Even better than us. But it's really special.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. I can't define what it is about the music. But I guess the other aspect about Irish music is that for various reasons, it blossomed into, as you mentioned, a thing in mostly pubs, but in various public venues all around the world, everywhere from China to Africa, Asia. Yeah. I don't know about Antarctica, but quite possibly.
And we have people from all over the world stopping in at our Irish music jam sessions here in Des Moines, too. We have a guy who comes probably once or twice a year from Japan, whose English is very broken, but Takashi.
Right.
He plays the bar. He plays the Irish drum.
And what's his nickname? I forgot.
Well, I don't know that.
He's got a funny nickname.
Oh. Don't we all? Anyway, I asked him, I said, how did a Japanese guy pick up the Irish drum. And he said he was visiting, he was in Texas for some reason, and he was walking by a pub, and he heard the music, and he went in, and he was particularly drawn to the drum. And he wanted to know what it was, and he picked one up, and he started learning. And he's quite good. He's very proficient.
He is.
Yeah. But we have people from France, from all over the country, from Ireland, of course, and others stop in and play. And it's to me, the core elements of a traditional session are that, you know, you're not performing, you're just having fun. You know, if people like what you're doing, that's great, but you're not there to please the crowd.
Right.
And also, the other thing is people are welcome. Other musicians are welcome.
That's right. Yeah, our session, I should say, the sessions that Ed and I attend are that way. They're not performances, but they're very welcoming. We've had some unusual instruments and, you know, maybe have tested the limits of our welcome.
which ones? I'm thinking of the washtub bass that showed up years ago and a cello once. What are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of, what was it? It was some kind of a droney instrument. It wasn't a shruti box. It was much louder than that. This was years ago.
A shruti box is almost like a castrated accordion.
Right. But it's a welcoming music. That's at the core of it, and it's I guess the other feature of it that I enjoy is the chance to, I guess, socialize.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that I don't enjoy a pint or two, but I'm not someone who goes out to a bar every night of the week to see my friends.
That's not what your wife told me, but anyway.
But there is a long tradition of public houses as being a place where people socialize.
Mm-hmm.
So this gives me and others a chance to do that. You know, I've gotten to know people, gotten to know about their lives, mm-hmm. and share a little bit once a week, mm-hmm. with people. Because you're not always playing. You're sometimes talking, chatting, you know, drinking in between. But it is a social occasion, and again, as Ed said, it's a worldwide thing. I've walked into bars in Detroit, Michigan, and had the same experience there.
Mm, yeah. And you also play with another band called the Barn Owl Band, and that is the band that provides the music for the monthly dances here.
Contra Dance
in the Des Moines area.
Mm-hmm.
And years ago, you had a moment of a Barn Owl fame.
A fleeting moment of fame, yes. We played on Garrison Keillor's Prairie Home Companion back in 2002, I think, thereabouts.
And that didn't launch your international stardom?
No.
No.
It did not. But
maybe this program will.
Yeah, you know, it gave us some visibility. We actually recorded a CD out of that. Not of that concert, but a subsequent performance in Ames. So,
How did Keillor's people end up contacting the Barn Owl Band?
We had a fiddle player named Jason Huntley, who, was a crackerjack fiddle player, and the band was playing at a pretty high level, and he learned that Garrison Keillor was coming to town, to Ames, and so he said, I'm going to send him our CD and see if we can get on the show. And it's actually not that unusual for local bands to be invited.
Yeah.
So we happened to be the local Ames band that were invited to play.
You weren't invited. You invited yourself.
Well, we presented ourselves.
Which is good.
We presented ourselves.
Yeah. And was it kind of nerve-wracking?
Extremely.
Yes.
This was the early days of online video, and there were little cameras on the edge of the stage. Mm. That made it even more nerve-wracking.
Right. Aren't you glad that this is just a radio show and not a...
I'm not nervous at all. This is great.
Yeah. So, my thought is not just Irish music, but traditional music, music that is kind of the people, that grows out of the life and work of people who are close to the land. I find it very inspiring. You know what I'll do sometimes? I will ask somebody to pick a letter from A to Z, and then I will Google, say you pick a G. I'll go online and I'll Google all countries that start with the letter G. And then I'll ask you to pick a number of one to whatever number is the top number of those number of countries. And then I'll just listen to them. I'll Google traditional music from, say, Germany or Greece or Guyana. And it's really, sometimes you get some dud stuff or Greenland in this case, right? And it's just, it's fascinating to me. And, you know, there are so many differences from like Irish music to any other type of music in the world, but you can also see strands and threads and similarities. And just a sense of being connected to the people through that more raw, basic, you know, content.
That's a great idea. I'm going to give that a try. I think I like that better than YouTube. Algorithm, feeding you stuff that it
right.
This
you create your own algorithm.
No, I like that idea. I really do.
Yeah, and, and occasionally I know that sometimes at our sessions, there will be people who jump in and play something that's not Irish. We have a gal who, every once in a while, it's a very meaningful song to her. She sings "Somewhere Over the Rainbow."
Yes.
We have another guy who likes to sing a Cajun tune. I think it's called "Nail That Catfish."
Oh, right.
Yeah. Is that Cajun? Maybe not. Maybe
no,
it's just,
that was actually a composed tune. It sounds trad, but it's composed.
Yeah, but there is a fellow who also does play a Cajun tune once in a while. Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that's good. That there are hardcore traditionalists who only want jigs and reels, and that's it. And if anybody's reading music, they'll scowl at you. But, just kind of lighten up and maybe bring in some new ideas once in a while and see what happens.
Right. Yeah. It has to be fun. It's not a chore, and it's not professional music. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, John, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us on this. I know we're you and I and three other Irish music ne'er-do-wells will be performing quite a bit in and around St. Patrick's Day, and the first of our many gigs is going to be in Harlan in Western Iowa, at Milk and Honey Restaurant, which is a great venue in and of itself. It's a restaurant that focuses on locally grown food.
Always a good time in Harlan. We've done this a few years.
Usually at a different place.
Usually at a different place.
Brickwall Gallery. This will be the first time we're at Milk and Honey. But yeah,
that's great.
And then we're also playing at the Greenfield Opera House, where you will be doing an aria, singing an aria solo. No, I made that part up.
I think you're mistaken.
Maybe we can talk Anna into doing an aria. And then we're doing a series of senior homes as well.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Yeah. St. Patrick's Day.
Or as we call it.
St. Patrick's Week.
St. Patrick's Week, yeah. That's right. We need a whole week. Anyway, thank you folks for listening. This is Ed Fallon with John Duvick. When I come back from a short break, Kathy Burns is going to join me. We'll be doing our weekly farm and food segment. Back with you in a minute on the Fallon Forum. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design build services for high performance, low maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay negotiated fee basis. Contact David Drake, FamilyPsychiatry.com. Hey, Kathy Burns is with me, folks, and we are talking, well, we have our farm and food segment. I have no idea where this is going. Let it rip.
It's time, Ed, for me to present to you a pop quiz about good greens.
What if I fail?
I'm going to have to, I guess, school you a little bit.
Okay.
So, because we have greens growing outside, even right now under our cold frames, and a lot of people are excited to start planting greens because they're good for us, I thought it would be fun just to see what we know and don't about which are the, quote, healthiest
That's
greens.
The royal we? You mean what we know means what I know?
No, what Harvard Health and what Healthline.com know.
All right.
Those are my two sources. I'm putting healthy in quotation marks because it's very individual.
Okay.
What is healthy for whom? Your age, you know, different things. Different people need different things.
All right, let's do this.
All right. So I'm going to ask you some questions. All the amounts of greens that I'm talking about will be 1 cup of raw, fairly roughly chopped greens. It equates to about a half of a serving of vegetables.
Okay.
I'm not sure how that pans out for the new food triangle that RFK introduced, we talked about last week. But here's your first question. Each of my two sources, Harvard Health and Healthline.com, offered a list of some of the most nutrition-dense and otherwise beneficial leafy greens. Name 3 leafy greens that you think are on this list.
Kale, collards, and mustard.
You have 2 out of 3 right. Mustard greens were not noted. That doesn't mean they're not healthy, but they just weren't noted on this list. The others, arugula, beet greens, cabbage, microgreens, which I disagree is an actual green.
Okay.
I think that's just all kinds of greens, romaine lettuce, spinach, Swiss chard, and watercress were at the top of the list. So question 2, which of these 4 leafy greens, I'm going to name 4, has the highest amount of vitamin C? The 4 are kale, watercress, green cabbage, and red cabbage.
Watercress.
No, I'm sorry. The answer is red cabbage.
Really?
Watercress has about 4 milligrams of vitamin C per the serving amount. It's the lowest.
Oh.
Next on the list.
Well, what do I know?
Next on the list is kale at 19 milligrams per serving, half serving. The next on the list is green cabbage at 28 milligrams, and the highest is red cabbage at a shocking 50 milligrams per serving.
I'm so embarrassed right now. Keep going.
Well, I chose some very off-the-wall questions just for the sake of conversation.
Okay.
I thought it was really interesting that the green and red cabbage have different nutrient
Yeah, it
contents.
Is. Yeah, I'm surprised, too. We had a really good red cabbage year this past year. The year before, we had a really good green cabbage year.
Mm-hmm.
And both years, the other one didn't do well at all.
And this year, for the first time, we made homemade sauerkraut.
We did.
That was really fun. Question 3, which of these 4 greens has the highest concentration of calcium? Swiss chard, collard greens, beet greens, or spinach? This is for calcium.
Spinach.
Again, no, I'm sorry. The lowest was Swiss chard at 18 milligrams. The second was spinach at 30 milligrams. Beet greens came in next at 44, and the highest was collard greens with 52 to 83.
I was going to go with collards, but that's too obvious anyway.
Yeah. My next question is, which leafy green of all that you know is known to be the least nutrient dense?
Iceberg lettuce.
Yes, you got it. Congratulations.
Iceberg lettuce is pretty much just cell wall, isn't it?
Well, I want to go back to the calcium question, though. This was very interesting. The high calcium content of the vegetable isn't as important as the ratio of calcium compared to a compound called oxalates, which bind to calcium. Swiss chard has a high calcium rate, but also a high oxalate rate, which means your body is not going to absorb the calcium contained therein.
Mm-hmm.
And collards are considered moderately high in oxalates. So although they contain it, your body may not absorb it.
And it also depends on how these things are cooked or whether they're eaten raw.
Well, I mentioned these are you know, raw amounts, but you're right. If you cook some vegetables, they do lose some nutrients.
Yeah.
So,
but they're also more edible.
I think
I would say collards, for example.
Yes.
I'm really not a fan of raw collards.
Not either. Or kale.
Collards with bacon grease. Yeah.
I can tolerate some raw kale if it's smashed with salt and mixed up with some tasty other stuff. But the lesson for me is still what we always knew, a variety, yeah. And then you're going to get what you need.
Yeah. In terms of greens, folks, cold frames. Now, if you're thinking about that, plant that in October, but you got to build your cold frame.
Well.
And, wow, I tell you, we have greens right now that we've already had a salad from one of our cold frames, even though it gets down below zero.
It's exciting.
I mean, it doesn't do well when it gets that cold, but hey, by the time March 1st rolls around, it's great stuff.
Go greens.
Thanks, Kathy, and thanks to our guests today, James Bruton and John Duvick. To our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Detterman, Charles Goldman, Kathy, and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. And thanks to our nonprofit partners. Thanks also to the Des Moines Iver Session for our bumper music. We'll be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.